Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Jodi Gold. She is the author of the newly released book, Screen Smart Parenting, How to Find Balance and Benefit in Your Child's Use of Social Media, Apps, and Digital Devices. Dr. Jodi and I will be discussing how educators and parents can manage the digital technology children and adolescents are currently exposed to. Good morning, Dr. Jodi. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. It's a pleasure to have you on the air with me. Screen Smart Parenting is a very interesting read. You are extremely thorough. The book is very comprehensive. It's got substantial amount of information with up-to-date insights regarding the cyber world. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
All right. Well, I'm sort of from all over the place. My family is Canadian, but I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. And then I went to the University of Pennsylvania. And after Penn, I actually spent a number of years in my 20s very involved with student activism around the movement to end sexual violence, sort of acquaintance rape and date rape. So I spent a couple of years actually working on a book with a small publisher and actually reaching out to kids around universities and building some conferences and that sort of thing. And then in my mid-20s, decided I was going to go to medical school. My plan in going to medical school was to do OB-GYN and to do women's health. That's what sort of drew me to medical school. And as I was in medical school, I found that I cared a great deal about, you know, women's health and OB-GYN, but I was really much more interested in the psychological piece. I found that I loved every rotation, but I really loved talking to the families in every rotation more than the actual, you know, sort of surgical piece. And that's how I ended up in psychiatry. And from there, I did my training at Cornell and New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York. And I trained in adult psychiatry and child psychiatry. And then I did a fellowship in what's called infant psychiatry, which is not talking to babies, but it is thinking about early attachment issues and early parenting issues and sort of the process of becoming a mother, whether you need reproductive technology, whether it comes very easily, and what it does for your identity, and how challenging and identity changing those years are for moms and dads and obviously for the babies. Mm-hmm. And after that, I had a family of my own. So I have three kids, a 6, 8, and 10-year-old, and I continued to work in psychiatry. I was the outpatient director at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Cornell, for the child psychiatry department for a few years and really enjoyed it. I got to teach residents and fellows that were learning how to do psychiatry with children and adolescents. And then a couple of years ago, decided to take the big leap out of sort of academia. Mm-hmm. And I am now on the voluntary faculty of Cornell, but I have a private practice and have been doing a lot of writing and spending time with my kids, but also seeing patients and writing. And that's where the Screen Smart Parenting comes in. And truthfully, a year and a half ago is when I decided to sort of embark on this project, Screen Smart Parenting. So I actually found that I was going to work every day and seeing these wonderful kids and adolescents, and every hour of my day something would come up about digital technology. You know, it would be the 7-year-old that couldn't get off Minecraft, or the 14-year-old girl that got broken up over text, or the frustrated parents that felt like their children didn't read anymore, they were on their devices all the time. And then I would leave work and go pick up my kids from school, and they were younger. Mm-hmm. And I would find at drop-off and pick-up that's what the parents were talking about. Are you letting your child play with the iPhone? Are you going to buy him an iPhone? You know, are they learning to read on an e-reader? Or are you making them read books? It just sort of didn't end. It was everywhere. And I actually started, I said, all right, well, there's got to be a solution to this. I'll just Google this, right, and get some answers. Right, that's what we do. We Google. So I went online and said, let me figure this out. There's got to be a thoughtful way to answer these questions. And what I found is that there really isn't yet. And I was really shocked by the lack of books and writing that was thoughtful about sort of how to raise our kids in the digital age. There was literally nothing written in from the medical community thinking about sort of developmental milestones and vulnerable kids and how that might change our approach to technology. And a lot of the things that were out there from educators and researchers often were scary. You know, the amount of time that kids are on devices is incredible, anywhere from, you know, 8 to 11 hours a day. And the dialogue was really very scary in terms of the idea that it was pulling our children apart, destroying their childhood. And that wasn't really what I was seeing. It wasn't what I was seeing with my family, and it wasn't what I was seeing with my patients. And I felt it was very important that we be honest with ourselves that this is the world that we live in, and that we need to figure out how to raise our kids in this world and how to use the devices to help them reach their milestones and help to augment their life, not take away from their life.
Very, so very interesting.
So that's how the idea for the book came about. And I was approached by Guilford, which is an incredible academic press, honestly, about writing a book about ADHD, which is an expertise of mine. But I sort of felt like there were a lot of books about ADHD, and I thought they were going to laugh at me. I was like, I don't want to write the book on ADD. There's a lot of good books written on that. But there's really not very much written from the standpoint of a mother and a physician on how to parent kids with this, the technology that we live in. And instead of laughing at me, they actually were like, wonderful, we love it, we'll support you, we want you to write this.
Well, and then you did a fantastic job.
Well, you did a fantastic
job with the book. It is wonderful. To me, the book is so relevant today, for one thing, because when you talk about parenting as a whole, let's face it now, what I've heard when I was growing up is that my parents have always told me, you know what, we have always tasted more salt of life than you have. That's living wisdom. So they can always share their wisdom with the kids. But having said that, when you talk about the digital age, parents know nothing. So we do need help from experts like you.
You know what's so interesting? There's this term that people use, which I love, which is called digital natives and digital immigrants. And if you use a sort of immigrant model, it's really helpful for parents of our generation to sort of understand the situation we're in. The current generation of parents are the last wave of digital immigrants to raise kids in the world. We're the last group of people, you know, people 30 and over, are the last group of people that did not grow up on the internet, that did not grow up holding an iPhone, yet we have to help our children chart that world. And we're dealing with a generation of digital immigrants, our children, who are much more comfortable with the language, they're much more fluid, it all comes much easier to them, the world of technology. And we have a choice as immigrants to either be fearful and afraid of sort of this new world that we're facing, or to try to embrace it and ride the wave with our children.
So true. Your book talked about digital citizenship and online resilience. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So thus far, when we talk about technology, most of the time we're really talking about it as sort of a toy. You know, what am I going to get for Christmas? I'm going to get the iPad for my child, or I'm going to get a smartphone for my child. And what's really important is that we shift the discussion away from this being about toys. It really might have been toys 20 years ago when you were playing a video game. But now technology is really a tool that we use in our lives. And that while we teach kids how to be good citizens, how to have ethics and be kind and giving and altruistic, we must also do that online. Because you have to remember that not so much maybe for you and I, but for our children, they will have a full digital identity. Whether they want to or not, it doesn't matter what field they pursue, they will have an identity offline, of course, and they will also have their presence online. It's virtually impossible at this point. So we need to be thoughtful as parents about how we're going to cultivate our child's identity. And part of that comes in two ways. One, by citizenship, which means being kind and thoughtful and being the kind of person you want your child to be offline, online. And there's so many ways to do that. There's so many ways to do social justice and community service. There's so many ways to help your friends out. Mostly it starts with just kindness, you know, helping the people you're online with, whether it's your classmates or the people in your church, being kind to them in whatever interactions you have. So teaching citizenship and applying it online is really critical. We need a generation of kids that grows up to be responsible in terms of how they use this technology. Part of becoming a good citizen means we have to teach resilience. There's a lot of discussion in the parenting literature, in the parenting world, mm-hmm. that we have to teach our kids grit and resilience. And researchers believe that the kids that have grit or resilience, whatever you exactly want to call it, are most likely to overcome obstacles in their life and most likely to be successful, regardless of what their background is. But we don't really talk about how one builds resilience online, even though our children spend more time online than they do offline. So one of the things I want parents to think about, and it's not easy, and I absolutely don't have all the answers. It's just the discussion I want to start, and that's about allowing your children to make mistakes online. I think as parents, our first instinct is to want to take away the phone or shut down the computer, which in many situations is very appropriate. But a lot of the times we have to not take away the phone. We have to not put on the filter. We have to allow our children to make little mistakes, kind of the skin-knee thing, so that they can learn from the mistakes. If they're a little bit mean online and you catch them being mean online and you turn it into a learning point, and from that point on they understand what it means to be kind online, that's much more effective than punishing them and taking the phone away for a month. So parents do know how to teach resilience in the world. It's all about you fall off the bike and you get back on the bike.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you become afraid of the bike or you don't develop the skills to ride the bike. That has to apply to your children's life online as well.
Very interesting. What are the categories covered in the book?
So it's a little bit ambitious what I tried to do. And I'll admit that now, but I realized when I started working on this that it would be nice to just sort of lay it all out there, and then, you know, later on things can be more fine-tuned. So what I start by doing is trying to do an overview of sort of parenting in the digital world, which means I believe very strongly that you can't even think about raising your kids in this world until you're really honest with yourself about what your own parenting style is and also what your own relationship with technology is. If you have, you know, the TV on in your house all the time and you can't go to sleep without your phone, you know, under your pillow, then you can't expect that your children aren't going to do the same thing. So the beginning of the book really asks you to take a look at sort of where you are in terms of your media diet and in terms of your parenting. And then the second piece of it is I'm trying to give parents a little bit of an overview of the landscape, because what I find is that most parents sort of shut down because they feel that they don't understand this world. And while you do not need to understand it at the same level as your children do, there's no reason to be afraid of it, and there's no reason not to learn a little bit of the language. So I've done like a very, very beginner primer sort of overview. And I've discussed a little bit of the hot topics, the topics that everyone talks about at pick up and drop off, in terms of dispelling some myths. You know, for instance, that, you know, being on screens does not cause ADHD. However, if your child has ADHD, you need to be more thoughtful. So just overviewing some of the debates. And then the crux of the book, really, coming from a pediatric background, what I really wanted to do was sort of look at digital milestones. You know, we talk about milestones when you're raising children, walking, talking, making friends, being independent, you know, eventually being in relationships. And I really feel at this point it's fair to talk about digital milestones. You know, when you first have your first phone, when you have your first relationship online, when you have your own social media, you know, and this is a progressive thing, just like growing up is. You don't start on Twitter at age six. It evolves. So what I've done is taken apart sort of 0 to 18, and I'm talking a little bit about the actual physical milestones and emotional milestones, and then I'm trying to help parents integrate the digital world, whether it's, you know, whether to use the iPoddy or what to do if your daughter's sexting. I've sort of broken it down by ages so you can kind of look where your kids are and sort of say, all right, this is by the time I get out of elementary school, my child needs to be able to do these things. They need to be independent. They need to be able to internalize rules. I need to make sure that my technology plan is in line with that. Mm-hmm. And then at the conclusion of the book, there's two parts to it. One is I talk a little bit about vulnerable children or sort of the ORCID children, which is what to do if your child doesn't fit in the box. I see a lot of kids who are anxious. Like, we talk a lot about, like, socially anxious kids, and they get on Facebook or they get on Instagram and it makes them feel worse. Or ADHD kids who really do get revved up with too much video game use. Those kids are not always in the box. So what I've tried to do, and this hasn't been done a lot, and I expect that in the next few years you're going to see a lot more discussion about this, is that I don't think that one size fits all. So I've tried to cover some of the vulnerabilities I think you might encounter. And in that case, you need a different plan. If your child is one of the really big take-home things is the rich get richer model, which is if your kids are socially skilled, they can actually get online and connect with their friends, feel good about themselves, make more friends. But if they're not socially skilled, they may get online and things may backfire. They may actually feel worse about themselves. And we can talk more about that. But that's that piece. And then at the end of the book, what I've tried to do is give some templates for family technology plans. By no means are these, you know, rules that you have to follow, but I have found that people want, we need more templates. We need some suggestions. You can hate all of them, but if it gets your family started in this discussion, then it's a victory. So I've got some templates on how to build a behavioral plan for your family and some ideas of things you might want to include.
Fantastic. I really like the book's layout. You cover just about everything with questions and quizzes as well as suggestions. One of the things that I want us to talk about right now is you have talked about in the book ways to promote online resilience. So let's talk a little bit about that if you don't mind.
Sure. So one of the big challenges now is all the images that your kids are going to get bombarded with. It is different than when we were growing up. There's no question about it. And a lot of the discussion sort of doesn't, we're not talking about Kim Kardashian. I actually think we should be talking about Kim Kardashian. Not honestly because I love Kim Kardashian, but because she has 24 million followers on Instagram.
Right.
So you may not be talking about Kim Kardashian or even want your children to be, but they are learning about it just by sheer numbers, they're being exposed to it. So when I talk about building resilience, just to give that as an example, you should be discussing this with your kids. Not if they're not ready, obviously. I don't mean you need to bring it up with a six-year-old. But at the point that your kids are bringing it up and you know they're seeing it, having these discussions can help to build resilience. Helping them to understand, for instance, that the images they see are not always real. They're often Photoshopped. There's great things online that show what you can do with Photoshop. And while we think this is obvious, it's not obvious to an 8- or 9-year-old. Children should be really critical consumers when they're looking online, and there should be this discussion at home, that things can be Photoshopped, that not everybody's consenting. There's a lot of discussion about porn online and the fact that the kids can get to that. And they can. So we have to be discussing it in a way so that they can... we should try to limit it, but the part that we can't limit, we should be discussing in a way that helps them understand it, meaning these images are not always real, these images are not always consensual, these images don't often reflect real people. So that's the kind of discussions you can have with kids, and it can be very easy with just looking at pictures online and asking them, does this really look like your friends? Do you know people who look like that? What do you think's been done to it? You know, what purpose does that serve?
Mm-hmm.
So what you're doing is you're giving your kids sort of an arsenal of tools to be more critical. They do this a lot in schools now.
Mm-hmm.
In the technology departments, when they look at websites, they teach kids not to just trust what you Google, right? Like, you can't just Google something and trust it because you can get any answer you want. They teach kids, and you should be doing this at home, how to look at a website and tell if it's an authentic or high-quality website. So you should be looking at who sponsors the website. Are they trying to sell something? Can you find out who the contact, like who the designer of the website is, and look at their credentials? Do they use? Do they have a bibliography that makes sense to support whatever they're talking about? And, you know, do they link to sort of credible sources? These are the kinds of things, and they do this a little bit in school, but not enough yet. You can do this at home with your kids, so that way they can tell the kind of websites they can trust versus the kind they can't trust. So in this day of growing up, when we were growing up, it was like, let's go to the World Book, let's go to the Britannica, let's try to find out the answer to how tall Niagara Falls is, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was all about finding the answer and getting the knowledge. It's not about that at all. You can ask Siri on your phone, and Siri, this is the voice activation voice on the iPhone will answer your question with some kind of answer. So that's not where we're focused with kids. We're focused with kids on learning to actually understand which answers to trust and which not to trust.
Very, very interesting.
So that's like that's an example. So looking at images with your kids and talking about what's been done to the images, there's very few images that haven't been doctored to some degree on the internet. And looking at websites and saying, well, why would you trust this website? This website is trying to sell yo-yos. So why are you trusting it, information on the yo-yo? And all of these things build some strength with your kids in terms of resilience. The other piece of resilience, which I mentioned, is really allowing kids to make mistakes. And this is really hard for parents. I mean, I get it as a parent. It's hard not just online. It's hard offline. But you have to do it online. The schools that I have found to be most progressive that I have worked with actually don't have filters in their schools. And I spoke to a technology department recently, and I asked them, why don't you have any type of filter? And they're like, well, we want the kids to make mistakes at school. Because if they make mistakes and they end up on a porn site, we want to know about it. Not because we're going to allow it or condone it, of course not. But because we want to, we think that, that offers us an ability to have a conversation about it. And somewhere we've got to be having conversations with kids about why it's bad that they ended up on that site. They're allowed to be curious, but like these sites are not appropriate, and why are they not appropriate? We have to have that discussion. So this school that I was speaking with, we're very progressive. I'm not sure that every school could handle this, but it's an example of they're really trying to build resilience.
So true.
So those are some examples of sort of how to build resilience. Oh, the other kinds of examples in terms of making mistakes are sort of the bullying mistakes. Like I worked with a child, I like this example, and he posted a picture of his best friend on Instagram picking his nose. He didn't mean, he's a whatever, 9-year-old boy, and he thought it was funny. The boy, of course, who saw it was humiliated and horrified. And asked him to take it down. And so this 9-year-old boy took down the picture and felt horrible and was crying and tearful in my office. And what I began to understand was is that he wasn't meaning to bully or taunt his friend. He thought it was actually funny. But he had accidentally been cruel online. This had been an embarrassing, cruel picture. And it was a pretty simple mistake, right? I mean, it's a pretty harmless thing that happened, but it allowed this child to build resilience in terms of what kinds of pictures do you post of friends? What does it feel like if someone posts an embarrassing picture of you? Which is inevitably going to happen in this world where people post thousands of pictures a month, right? So you need to know what it feels like, be able to manage it, and to be really thoughtful. I ask teenage girls to be really thoughtful about when and how they post, because sometimes it's mean, even if they don't mean it to be mean.
So true. Your book talks about finding balance, and you've given us some wonderful tidbits so far. What are some of the challenges parents face in customizing digital technology for their child?
So it's challenging. So I want to be clear about that from the beginning. Trying to find balance is not easy. And I think it's one of those things that we're all striving for. I actually, and I do this at my own home, is that I'm striving to find balance, and I actually will discuss that with my kids because I want them to understand that it's not so easy. It's not so easy for me, and when I mess up and I'm on the phone when I should be with them, I want them to understand that I'm not perfect and that I'm constantly trying to put away the phone and constantly trying to find balance, but that it's just not it's not a black and white thing. You don't turn it on and off. It's not like I have balance or you don't. It's this fluid sort of thing that we're all striving for in technology, but also in our world. So I think finding balance is challenging, and I want my kids to know that it's challenging. And some days you'll be better at it than other days. But the challenges are, there's a myriad of challenges. Number one, the challenge is the reality that parents especially are supposed to be connected all the time. I have parents tell me all the time, you know, I work in the news or I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon. I have to be available all the time. So it's hard to model balance when you can't turn off your own devices, right? And then on top of that, one of the other challenges is that it's wonderful that schools are now online and are moving towards that, and it is the future and it is what we should be embracing. But it does make it harder now. Once your kids are over after fourth grade, it's impossible to determine what's work online and what's play online. it's all gotten very sort of blurry.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes a big challenge in terms of setting guidelines, because you want your kids to use the technology as a tool. So there's a whole kind of challenges. The challenges we have in setting being role models for our kids, the challenges that children really do use technology as a tool and need it for their life.
Mm-hmm.
So those are, to me, the two biggest challenges that we face in trying to figure out how to set a plan for our kids. But my biggest advice on that is getting your kids involved, especially kids that are over 8 or 9 years of age, you know, mm-hmm. between 9 and 18, getting them involved with trying to figure out what are reasonable limits and times and ways to use the devices.
Interesting. Is there an appropriate age to introduce a child to digital technology?
But that is a funny question to ask these days, because I think that pretty much it starts at birth to some mm-hmm. degree. So mm-hmm. I think that this idea, it's just coming out. There's recently been some really interesting stuff published from the 0 to 3-year-old organization on technology with babies. The Academy of Pediatrics has always said no technology prior to the age of 2, absolutely none. There's been some backsliding on that these days, where people are sort of recognizing that technology in moderation that's not used in lieu of human interaction is probably not harmful for kids. So I think the reality is that kids get exposed to it as early as birth. When you should be actively introducing it is later than that, of course. I think that kids, there's all kinds of wonderful interactive apps, and by age 3, kids really can learn online. They can use the apps to actually grow mm-hmm. And learn to read. So it basically, we're introducing our kids to technology from birth on, but we want to do it in a graded, thoughtful way. So at 3, it's fine for them to be learning their numbers and their letters mm-hmm. on an app, but they don't need to sit in front of, you know, they shouldn't be on social media. They don't need their mm-hmm. own iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on which part of technology we're talking about as to sort of which ages are appropriate.
So when does the child get an iPhone?
That's always the million-dollar question. And it's getting younger and younger. And with Christmas coming up, I think I get this question every day. So here is the issue with the phones, with the smartphones is what we'll say,
yeah.
is there are reasons to give your children smartphones before middle school. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about that for a minute. In general, I don't recommend that kids have smartphones in elementary school. The exceptions to that are if your parents are divorced and you use the phone to connect to the non-custodial parent.
Right.
So if you want to say goodnight to your mother on your own phone when you're at your father's house, then that's a reason to buy a child a phone. If your child takes long bus rides, has to do logistics, and there becomes a safety issue, that's
right.
another reason to give your child a phone. If there is an issue with an illness, for instance, they are out of school for a couple of weeks and they want to stay in contact with people, or there's some anxiety involved with going to school, there can be appropriate reasons to give your child a phone between the ages of, you know, 7 and 9. But I would really only consider that in those kinds of extenuating circumstances. After that, I really think that sort of 5th grade, 10 and up, is when you can really start thinking about it. It's mostly related to what your community is doing. And I don't mean that in like you should succumb to peer pressure. I'm not suggesting
that. Right.
What I'm suggesting is that at a certain point, your child's friends will begin to communicate and interact with each other online. And at that point, you have to make a decision about whether you want your child involved with that or not. And that varies with gender, and it varies from community to community. But I pretty much see, at least right now where I am, I'm in New York City, that kids are pretty much getting phones between the ages of 10 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
And by 6th grade, 7th grade at the latest, they're really using them to interact. And by that time, also, a lot of the schools, you're allowed to dismiss yourself from school. So
mm-hmm.
That's an age by which, or you're walking to school alone. So by that age, kids are able to use it as a somewhat of a safety issue, but they're also use it to, you know, as a tool. So
yeah.
the big take home, and this is the big issue with Christmas coming up,
mm-hmm.
is that you should be giving your child a phone when they're ready to use it as a tool and not a toy.
Right.
And
or in this case, being fashionable.
Yeah, right, right. Not an accessory. That's even better. Not just a toy or a fashion accessory, right?
Yeah.
If it's a fashion, if the reason they want it is a fashion accessory, that's not a good reason. If they're actually using it to keep track of their homework and they're making plans with their friends and they use it to keep you in the loop and they're texting you, they're probably ready.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to play down the toy fashion accessory thing. In my family, we really give technology, actually not always at holidays. Sometimes we'll give smaller holiday presents because this is all expensive, but give the technology when we feel like they need it. So they begin to understand that it's a privilege and it's expensive, but that we want them to use it as a tool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the shift. You know, when they can really use it, it's probably appropriate. And then it's very important that they understand that this is an expensive device and that they have to be responsible with it. And the big things about it are that you cannot sleep with your phone. You don't need to eat with your phone. No, the sleeping is a big issue.
Yeah.
I actually, in the book, call it the eye blankie. I think kids move now from, like, the blankie to the eye blankie. And the ground rule has to be, when you give your child a phone, that the phone sleeps in another room. parents will always say to me, but wait, they use it for their alarm clock. How will they get up? And I'm saying,
right.
You know, they still sell wind-up alarm clocks for, like, $4.99.
Right.
And so I kind of think that when you give your child the smartphone for Christmas or Hanukkah, you might give them the, like, you know, wind-up alarm clock with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because that's not what it's about. It's not about having it, that it's the first thing you see in the morning, it's the last thing you see at night. So that's a big issue. So, you know, those are the kinds of limits that you want to be thoughtful about, and that as a parent you should be modeling for your children.
You brought up something very interesting. The challenge here would have seen sometimes it is the parents that wants to give a smartphone. The child don't need that, but it's the parents that decide that, well, I want to make sure that my child looks better than the other person's child and so forth. How do you address that issue?
That's a good question. So there's the status issue, which has become a big deal, and there's also, along with that, this fear that parents have that kids need to keep up. And I don't mean just keep up with having all of the fancy stuff, but also there's a fear that your children will fall behind and that in order to be successful, you need to be the first to have the computer and the first to have the phone. That's just not true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is there's not even so much of a digital divide. One of the great things that the technology revolution has done is it's equalized things a little bit. It's given access to lower income people an opportunity to be as effective as upper class people because it's really taken such a far reach and there's so many devices that are less expensive and they're in the schools. So I really don't think that parents need to worry that their children need to be the first to do anything with technology. They're going to get it. It's everywhere. The average kid spends somewhere like 7.75 hours to 8 hours a day on technology. And that's really a low ball number. And that's from the Pew, those are the approximate numbers from like the Pew Research Report. And those are dated numbers. So I expect those numbers are higher. So do not worry that your child is going to fall behind if they are the last to get a computer or the last to get an iPhone. I'm not worried about that. But in terms of the status, the parents really have to rein themselves in. Like, I'd rather that they bought a fancy necklace or bought a fancy guitar or something for their kids and stayed away from getting into this rat race with the devices. Because it goes nowhere and it really sends the wrong message.
Wonderful advice. Let's talk about child development. One of the things that you covered in detail, which is really good, is how digital technology affects a child's development. Let's talk about that.
Yes. So a lot of the stuff that's out there is concerned about the fact that we're going to hurt our children's development with technology, that kids don't know how to do research anymore, that they rely on technology, that they don't make friends because they're always online. So there's a lot of research and a lot of writing out there on how it hurts our child's development. But I think most people who are in the world of raising kids and working with kids realize that it's actually a very powerful tool to help with development. It just needs to be thoughtful. So for instance, with young kids, little kids, I think that the reading apps and the math apps are fantastic. I don't see any reason not to expose your children, in moderation, of course, to these great math and reading apps. And if it, there's probably nothing in, it's not like they learn it better because it's on the device. That's not the case. But if it draws them in or it has, you know, some sparkles that they like, why not? So I love the educational apps for young kids. The problem with the educational apps is by the time kids are literate, by age 8, you know, the vast, vast majority of the educational apps on the App Store are designed for kids under 8. By the time you're in like second, third grade, the educational apps like kind of go away to the games and stuff. So for the young kids, I think that the apps actually can help with academic milestones. Mm-hmm. I think that in terms of the social milestones of middle school, of late elementary school, and of middle school, I think that the devices should be used to help kids organize themselves, to help them plan ahead, executive functioning, which is something we talk a lot about, helping kids to plan ahead and to be organized, which is really the key to being successful as an adult. The devices can help with that. The other thing that it can do as kids get a little bit older in middle school and into high school is it can help them with their identity development. The way kids present themselves online, they have an opportunity to curate their own identity. They have an opportunity to explore passions and interests. If you're interested in fashion, I have this great teenager that I work with who's fantastic. He's really interested in fashion, and she has her own blog, and she puts up pictures, and she connects people to stores, and she has found something she's passionate about, and she's able to use the tools of technology to cultivate her interests.
Mm-hmm.
So that's with older kids. So I think that with the oldest kids, they should be using technology to find interests and passions and cultivate them. In the more middle and later elementary and middle school, I really think it's an opportunity to learn to organize yourself, to plan ahead, to connect to people, to understand the meaning of friendships. Like this whole friends and likes and hearts and pins is an opportunity to really think about friendship, because those are not friends. Those are social media likes.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that the technology becomes sort of an opportunity for discussion about what are real friends, what are friends online, how can I get support from my friends online? There was an interesting study I read at one point that said that adolescent and middle school boys were more comfortable mm-hmm. talking about their feelings via text, via electronic communication.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about overexposure and sexting. That's a different issue. I'm talking
right.
about just being able to talk about your feelings. That's something
right.
about the anonymity of the text, and texting is always with one other person, that's what we're talking about, allowed them to open up to their friends a little bit more in a very positive and healthy way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another discussion is, you know, how much
yeah.
sharing should you do?
Right.
But this is an opportunity, and that's why it's a very nuanced discussion. But having middle school boys be able to talk about their feelings with a friend via text is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's an opportunity for them to use the technology to talk about their feelings, to connect to someone. And then, of course, the flip side of that is, and we should be talking about this, is helping kids to not overshare or overexpose
right.
themselves.
Right.
And
right.
that's also something that parents, more than the school even, have to be involved with, right? Like, it's true, we understand about adolescent friendships that self-disclosure is one of the key things that helps glue the friends. You know, you tell them something about
right.
yourself private, and that kind of connects you, and that sort of builds the foundation for a friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That is how we build friendships, if done in moderation. Kids need to understand that, but learn that they don't need to tell the whole world on social media their whole life.
Right.
But that's a nuanced skill. That's now a developmental skill that parents need to work on. Like, what do you put online, and to whom do you put it online with, and when do you put it online? Like, when is it appropriate? Like, if you just met this girl, it's probably not time to tell her about the surgery that you have, you know, last year.
Right.
But it may be fine to use your friends as a support if you're not feeling well in another setting. So since so much of adolescence is about identity formation and relationships, we can use the technology, if we do it right, to help cultivate all of that.
Very, very interesting. What is the number one social media network that children gravitates to first?
So in terms of where kids start,
mm-hmm.
right now I would say that kids start in Instagram. There mm-hmm. are social media sites designed for kids that are sort of designed for like 10 and under, things like Club Penguin, which is a Disney website that's very monitored and appropriate, and I love it when kids want to start on that. The other places that little kids start is sort of more creatively. They will start on things like Club Penguin, but they'll also start on things like Minecraft, fantasy football, what happens is they are using the device for the game or for the football, and then they'll begin to interact with other people playing fantasy football, mm-hmm. or they'll go to the from the creativity mode on Minecraft to the one where you compete against people, and all of a sudden now they're interacting with people through the games. So that is where the social media first starts. And then from there, it tends to move into more visual stuff, like Instagram and sometimes Snapchat. Even though you're supposed to be 13 to sign on to them, I think a lot of younger kids are on Instagram. And there isn't mm-hmm. necessarily anything wrong with being on Instagram if you're posting pictures of your favorite football player or of your cat or, you know, that kind of thing. So that's mm-hmm. how I see it starts. And then it evolves into the other stuff. Facebook, as we know, is on the mm-hmm. way out for kids. Anything that we're really using, obviously, our kids are not going to use anymore. I mean, that's common knowledge, right? So now, you know, so there, we go from like sort of an Instagram to maybe a little Facebook, but more into sort of the Twitter and Snapchat and Tumblr and that kind of stuff. And then it sort of evolves. And I love some of it. Some of it's great. You know, writing your own blog is a fantastic way to cultivate your interest, to become a better writer, to cultivate your identity, to connect to people that have shared interests. So there can be ways, parents need to be creative here, there can be ways that your kids can use social media that can be wonderful for them.
Very interesting. Yeah, very, very interesting.
But you do have to know what they're doing. I mean, that's the other mm-hmm. piece. Is that mm-hmm. you do have to ask. Like, you should know what social media your kids are on. You just need to know what they're doing, right? Like, you don't have to understand yeah. how to tweet, but you do need to know that they're on Twitter and sort of look at what they're posting on Twitter.
How should divorced parents handle access to social media network for their children?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. So, in a perfect world, this is one area where divorced parents need to actually communicate with each other and have a consistent plan. The best way to co-parent as a divorced parent is to actually have sort of to communicate clearly with each other and not undermine each other. So I'm allowed to play Minecraft at dad's house, but not at mom's, or I'm allowed to be on Twitter until 3:00 in the morning at mom's, but not at dad's. There has to be consistency. Which is obviously very challenging often with divorced families. But if there's ever an area that's worth actually getting someone else involved, like a therapist or a parent facilitator, this would be it, to sort of have the parents agree on general guidelines that you're going to use across families, knowing that it's going to be slightly different in each home. And then the next piece is the monitoring piece. And it really depends on how well the parents communicate. I'm okay with only one of the parents following on social media as long as they actually communicate with the other parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I saw that he posted on Instagram this inappropriate picture. Did you address it with him? If the parents can have that kind of communication, that's fine. If not, they both need to be following their kids on social media and looking at their kids' history occasionally and, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends on how well, you know, what kind of divorced family it is.
Very interesting. You briefly talked about having children phasing out of Facebook, but for those who are active on Facebook, should parents follow their child on Facebook?
Yes, 100%. You should follow your kids on all social media sites. You can be seen and not heard.
Mm-hmm.
There is no reason to comment, post, even like thing mm-hmm. On your children's Facebook page, but they should know that you're always present. Because the rule of thumb is that you shouldn't be posting anything on any of these sites that you really wouldn't want your mom to see. Right? I mean, you know, truthfully, your teacher at school can read it, your potential employer, your college, the NSA, mm-hmm. Google, who knows? None of this stuff is private. So
right.
The idea that only your mom doesn't know is kind of silly. So I believe very strongly in privacy. I believe very strongly that you can buy, along with the alarm clock, you can buy the diary at the pharmacy store and at the pharmacy, and you can write in your diary, and you can lock it up, and you can put it under your bed. And I'm telling all parents, don't read that diary. That's privacy. Once you're posting things on social media, privacy is not the appropriate word. There is no privacy. You don't even own most of the data. Facebook mm-hmm. owns it or Instagram owns it. So
right.
parents should be there. And that's what I'm saying about divorced parents. They don't both have to be on Instagram, but one of them has to be, or Facebook. That's why you need to know, you need a list of what social media sites your teenager's on, and you need to be on all of them. You don't have to know how to use them. You don't have to comment. You don't have to be obnoxious. You just have to be there.
Interesting. How can parents track and stop cyberbullying?
Yes. Well, cyberbullying kind of all connects to sort of our digital kindness and our resilience piece.
Yeah.
From the very beginning, and this is really starting now in elementary schools, you have to, it's a conversation you should be having at home, which is basically, you know, how to be an upstander, not a bystander online, what to do when you see mean stuff going online, how not to be involved. It's very easy to get sucked into cyberbullying, because if you're on a group chat, which I really think are the most evil of all of the, the problems in terms of culprits, because you get this sort of mass mentality on these group chats, and these kids
mm-hmm.
get, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of texts, because there's so many kids on it texting. So mean behavior really evolves there. And those can be hard to get out of. It's not always that easy to get off the group chat. So there's all cyberbullying takes all kinds of forms. Mostly it starts by teaching our kids about kindness and about what mean behavior is and about coming to your parents or your teachers if you see anything that's mean or that makes you feel uncomfortable in any way. And then in terms of the really scary cyberbullying that we hear about, again, if anybody makes you feel uncomfortable in any way, they ask for information, they say something that's not nice, you're not sure who they are, anything at all, you should go to your parents. And parents need to be very careful not to punish their children for coming to them with this kind of information. Because if Billy comes to you and says, well, I was on the computer at 3 o'clock in the morning, but this weird guy said these mean things to me, as a parent, you have multiple ways to react. You can be angry at him for being on the computer at 3 a.m., which on some level you should be, or you can say, oh my gosh, you know, it's terrible that he made you feel this way. Let's figure out who this is. Let's shut this guy down. Let's block him.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get angry at the child because they were using it inappropriately, you've shut down the conversation. And then the next time the child really feels cyberbullied, he won't come to you. So you
right.
have to keep an open dialogue. So that you can help assess, you know, sort of inappropriate behavior. So it's a complicated thing. Kids really get it. They think parents are overreacting about cyberbullying. I think there's
right.
a real range of cyberbullying. The stuff that I see on a day-to-day basis is more what I would call cyber exclusion,
mm-hmm.
which is the classic Instagram. I invited my two best friends to go to a party with me. And I didn't invite my other two friends. And then I post in real time pictures of us at this great party.
Mm-hmm.
And all of my friends that I didn't invite get to see these pictures in real time on how they were excluded.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's really hurtful. It's not cyberbullying, but it's
right.
really hurtful. And it's not the same as when we were growing up, because we missed all kinds of parties and events because you're never invited to everything, right?
Right.
But you didn't know about it in real time. You found out 4 days later when someone made a joke. Or maybe you never found out, you know?
Right.
But now you find out in real time. And kids will do all kinds of stuff like tagging, like posting a picture of a
mm-hmm.
cat and tagging one best friend but not their other friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you've done is you've made the statement, at least that's the way sometimes kids will interpret it, is you've made the statement that she's my best friend. But what about the other two or three girls that thought they were the best friend? So
mm-hmm.
this is not the end of the world kind of stuff, but this is the real kind of exclusionary stuff that goes on all the time. And parents can do something about that, because you can ask your kids to not post in real time about parties and things that other friends weren't invited to. You can ask people not to tag certain friends if other friends are going to feel bad. There's ways to be kind and to get rid
mm-hmm.
of some of the milder kind of bullying stuff. And
mm-hmm.
with the really serious cyberbullying, we got to get them coming to their parents and the parents taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Very insightful advice. Are there ways to enforce limits in a household where parents are also digitally engaged?
You mean the consequences, or you
mm-hmm.
mean how to set limits?
Yeah.
Yes. So, and as I said, that's why the cornerstone of the book, and also more importantly of sort of your plan, is being honest with your relationship with technology and not asking your children to do things that you actually can't do.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, I think that you can, because there needs to be screen-free times in your life. Bedtime is a screen-free time when you're sleeping. Mealtime is a perfect opportunity if you have a sort of everyone sitting down to not have devices. And then I also encourage families to create screen-free times, whether it's 15 minutes or an hour. It sort of depends on who your family is, but that you find a time every evening where everyone's unplugged. And if it can only be 15 minutes, it's only 15 minutes. You know, this is not setting up something to feel bad. It may be that that's what can happen. It's about always striving to find a little bit of space where you're really feeling very present with each other and that the devices, you know, are in the kitchen. So that's one of the, and, you know, and there's a time and place for things. With kids, organic built-in reinforcement is the way to go, which what I mean by that is, you come home from school, you go to soccer practice, you do your homework, you have dinner, and then if there's a little bit of time before bed that you want to be on technology, that might be appropriate, right? Mm-hmm. Because you've sort of done everything else you need to do. And if you run out of time and there's not time, then you're not on the device. It's time to go to bed. Mm-hmm. But the idea being that we can fit this in. Our life doesn't have to revolve around it. It can fit into our life.
Wonderful. Your book also addresses tweens and texting and sexting and so forth. Let's talk a little bit about that. What are your thoughts?
The texting is a huge responsibility, and it's often the first thing that happens. It often happens before the social media. You're asking where kids start. I think that the first social connection, not so much like the Minecraft piece, but the social connection piece comes with text. You get your phone, even if it's not a smartphone, most phones have texting capability, and kids start texting. And this is something that parents really need to pay attention to. Texting's wonderful. It's convenient. It's an easy way to stay connected. There's nothing inherently wrong with it. The issue in middle school is the hypertexting, which is supposedly defined as over 120 texts per day, but the average middle school girl texts over 120 texts a day. So by the current definition, pretty much the average middle school girl hypertexts. And what happens with the hypertexting is it's just a lot of responsibility. You know, what I have found is that I always encourage parents to have the phone in another room when kids are doing homework. I never tell parents to take away the phone. It feels punitive, and it's not the point. Mm-hmm. It's to encourage your tween to put the phone elsewhere so they can focus on their homework. So a lot of once you have that conversation with kids, usually they get it and they're kind of on board. But what will happen is they will go and take a break, and they'll be 300 texts. They'll actually do homework for an hour. It takes me like a month to get 300 texts, but they'll get 300 texts in an hour. And I know you think I'm exaggerating with these numbers, but if you talk to a middle school girl, I'm not exaggerating on that 300 texts. So you can imagine how hard it is to manage this. So I have heard tween girls, especially girls, but the boys are texting too, just to be clear, find that it's a huge responsibility. And and you feel bad not responding. You know, this is the problem with texts. The conversation never ends.
Right.
Like, when does it end? When I'm texting friends, I'm never sure. Are we done? Do I need to say goodbye? Like, there's like no goodbye. So there's a lot of responsibility. So what I try to help with kids, I like that they're texting. I think it's great. There's nothing wrong with it. What I will ask kids to do is to prioritize the texts. If a friend texts you and says, I don't understand my math problem, can you help me? You should respond to that text. If there's a group text that has generated 50 texts in the last hour, you don't have to respond. Grown-ups think it's rude. Like, you know, as a grown-up, you're like, well, you have to respond if someone texts you. Not if you get 300 texts in 2 hours, you don't. This is all about finding balance, right? And not having the texting feel intrusive and overwhelming. So the kids really need to learn. You should absolutely respond to people that need your help or that are asking a specific question. But these general texts that are out there, you don't have to respond. The other way to help tweens manage texting is for them to tell their friends that when they're doing their homework and when they're at sports practice and music practice, they are not allowed to text. So you can send, Mary Jane a text, but if it's between 4 and 6 or 6 and 8, she's not going to respond to you. Mm-hmm. That way you help to manage your friends' expectations, because I think there gets to be a lot of pressure that their friends will think they're rude if they don't respond. Mm-hmm. So tweens need to help manage each other's expectations about how much texting they can do. So the texting is wonderful in moderation. Tweens don't do it in moderation, so they need help from their parents in figuring out, picking and choosing how much time they're going to spend on texting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sexting piece is obviously a really important issue, and that is the idea of sending, you know, sexy or nude pictures over electronic communication. So that can be via a text or social media or Snapchat,
yeah.
which is an important app for parents to know about. Snapchat
mm-hmm.
is an app where you can send a picture to a friend, and you can and it supposedly disappears, and you can set the amount of time before it disappears. I think it's up to 10 seconds. The problem with Snapchat is that children, tweens, think that the pictures actually disappear. But
mm-hmm.
just to be clear, nothing in cyberspace actually disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a trick, which kids know but parents don't know, that you can screen shoot a Snapchat picture, which means
right.
you can take a picture of the image on your phone. Now, in theory, the person who sends the picture is sent a message told that, you know, I just Snapchatted you a picture and you screenshot it, so I now know that you have that image.
Mm-hmm.
But there's apparently apps out there now where you can undo that. So you can screen shoot a Snapchat, and the sender doesn't know you did it. So while it's harmless in a lot of ways, and it is, there's nothing wrong with Snapchat. The way most kids use it, it's actually just a way of communicating through images that kids love. But it's also important to understand that it's really problematic for sexting.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no issue with Snapchat. It's not something that I understand at my age, in my 40s, but kids love it. It's sort of the way
yeah.
communication has evolved. It's like shorter than a tweet, and it allows
yeah.
them to communicate through pictures. That's fine as long as you're not sending sexy pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back to sort of this idea of what kind of identity do you have? Who do you want to be online? And that's a hard one because Kim Kardashian and even Madonna present themselves so sexualized online.
Mm-hmm.
So kids are like, oh, I want to be like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to have a conversation with them that's, you know, are you sure that's the kind of person you want to present yourself to be? And then
right.
kids have to understand, I mean, apparently everybody sexts. If you ask people in their 20s, they will tell you that sending pictures back and forth is just commonplace.
Right.
And that's kind of a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's something that you have to be aware of. It's unfortunately why people are always asking me why I have to look at my kids' texts, because isn't a text just like a phone call? And my parents didn't listen to my phone calls, so why am I looking at my child's mm-hmm. texts? And one of the major reasons to look at their texts is to make sure that they're not sexting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're confident that they're not, that's one thing, but it's the percentage is so high that you shouldn't
right.
be overly confident. Like, I would warn parents to be overly confident because it's not considered, like, inappropriate in most circles
mm-hmm.
to sext.
Mm-hmm.
And the definition is very broad. So most kids will tell you that they know that they shouldn't send a picture to somebody else with them being completely naked.
Mm-hmm.
But that there's a continuum as to sort of how sexy you can be. And kids have explained to me that there's ways to sext. They take pictures without their face showing.
Right.
So they feel like if they're taking a picture without their face showing, then no one can really trace it back to them.
Right.
Of course, that's completely untrue. But you can now understand how kids are making the arguments that it's sort of okay to do that.
Right.
So parents, that's why parents, yeah, have to monitor, and it's a real part of life now, so there has to be a conversation about it.
Very interesting. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading Screen Smart Parenting?
I would like for parents to leave not being afraid and being excited for their kids' digital journey,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like for them to be thoughtful with their children about how to use this digital journey to sort of cultivate and promote your child's development. And I want it to be a conversation starter. There's no way at this point that I have the answers or that anybody has the answers, and I in no way want to present myself in that way. I just want to start the conversation.
Fantastic. Where can someone go to buy the book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
So you can go to my website, which is www.screensmartparenting.com. That's screensmartparenting.com, where you can find out information about me and the book and what's going on. And you can also buy the book at Barnes & Noble and Amazon and at Guilford's site, the publishers. And Guilford is G-U-I-L-F-O-R-D, Guilford Press. Yeah, so you can check it out.
Wonderful.
Oh, and that's the other thing you can download. If you go to my website, you can actually download some of the templates, or on the Guilford website. If you want to just see what I'm talking about with these templates, you can just download them and look at the templates. It's better if you've got the book, because the book sort of builds up to the templates, but it can give you some ideas to get started at home.
Wonderful. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
I've been trying to think about this recipe for living. I love it. I've got so much to say. I really encourage my kids and myself to find things that I'm passionate about and to go for them. And that what really makes life worth living is to just engage, to find things that are exciting and take some risks and go for it. So that's basically it. And then I know, working with families and my own family, that we're always talking about balance, especially as a working mom with young kids. And I love balance, and we're working towards balance, but I also feel like people need to give themselves a break. Balance is fluid. You don't turn it on and off. It's something we're always striving for. So I'm kind of like, let's be passionate and let's constantly strive for balance, which we will not always achieve, but we got to go for it. And that's it.
Dr. Jody, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Reverend Becca Stevens. She is the founder of Madeline and Thistle Farms. Reverend Becca was recently named 2014 Humanitarian of the Year by the Small Business Council of America. Reverend Becca and I will be discussing how we can use hope and love as a powerful force to affect social change from her latest book, The Way of the Tea and Justice. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Dr. Jody, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed day. Bye-bye.